fire over 60 rockets at Israeli military targets after regime warplanes strike at northeastern Lebanese city of Baalbek. It's now day 170 of U.S.-Israeli genocide in Gaza. The Israeli regime's relentless bombardment and shelling continue to claim innocent Palestinian lives. In Rafah, Palestinians have been mourning their loved ones killed in Israeli airstrikes in this southern city earlier.
I heard the news around 2:15 in the morning that these people were killed. I went to the house and we helped other people and recovered children. We pulled three children from beneath the rubble and they are in the European hospital now and my son is with them. These are the crimes of the occupying Israeli regime in the Muslim fasting month of Ramadan. The children who have nothing to do with anything, have nothing to do with any organization on this land, these are innocent people.
The Gaza Health Ministry says that 84 Palestinians lost their lives in Israeli strikes in a matter of 24 hours. The death toll from a U.S.-backed campaign of genocide in Gaza, which started back on the 7th of October, has now surpassed 32,200, most of them women and children. Also, over a million displaced Palestinians are currently sheltering in the southern city of Rafah, which is located on the border with Egypt. Israel's also vowed to go ahead with a ground invasion of Rafah, despite international warnings that it will severely aggravate the already catastrophic situation for Palestinians. Our correspondent Moti Abu Musabe says Israeli forces have been stepping up their attacks on the Gaza Strip, leaving behind more civilian casualties.
The Israeli occupation forces continue to maintain their strikes and attacks against several areas of Gaza Strip, inflicting more destruction and death among the people and among the residential areas and buildings across all areas of Gaza Strip. Let's begin with Rafah City, whereas the Israeli occupation warplanes carried out several relentless airstrikes against the residential buildings, particularly in Al Brazil neighborhood located in the eastern part of the city, whereas at least seven Palestinian civilians were reportedly killed, including women and children, while dozens are still trapped under the rubble of those destroyed houses. In the meantime, the Israeli military boats opened their gunfire towards the coastal area of Deir el-Balah city. When it comes to Khan Yunis city, the Israeli occupation forces also continued their strikes. Many belts of fire were carried out by the Israeli occupation forces against the western parts of the city and even the eastern part of the city amid the heavy bombardment of the Israeli artillery that reached the east and the west and the center of the city. In the meantime, the Israeli special forces actually attempted to sneak out towards the surrounding areas of the Nasser Medical Complex. However, the Palestinians uncovered that special force and engaged in fierce clashes with it.
The UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres, on a visit to the doorstep of war-ravaged Gaza, has appealed for a ceasefire and the delivery of aid into the territory. Here he is.
Nothing justifies the collective punishment of the Palestinian people. Now more than ever, it is time for an immediate humanitarian ceasefire. It is time to silence the guns. Palestinians in Gaza, children, women, men, remain stuck in a non-stop nightmare.
Guterres was speaking in a visit to Rafah, the crossing on the Egypt-Gaza border there. He described a long line of blockaded relief trucks on one side of the gates and starving Palestinians on the other, a moral outrage. The UN chief said choice was between increasing aid or starvation. And Guterres said the continuation of the war will only make the humanitarian situation worse. He also warned Israel against launching its ground invasion into Rafah. The Gaza Strip is struggling with severe shortages of food, water, medicine, and fuel, and Israel has blocked the entry of almost all these essentials into the besieged territory since onset of its genocidal campaign on October the 7th. Another Israeli soldier has been killed in clashes with Palestinian fighters inside the besieged Gaza Strip. The Israeli military said 21-year-old staff sergeant was killed in central Gaza, and his death brings to 252 number of Israeli soldiers killed in Gaza since the regime began its ground invasion back in November. Palestinian resistance groups, however, say the actual number is much higher, that the regime is undercounting its losses for fear of Israeli public anger. Meanwhile, Hamas says it will not release captives held in Gaza without a commitment by the U.S. and Israel to end the genocide in the besieged territory. Senior official Sami Abu Zuri said U.S. and Israel are refusing to make that commitment, and this means they want a resumption of war, killing, and destruction. He cited Israel's rejection of a plan by Hamas earlier this year. Under a ceasefire proposal, Israel would have freed between 700 to 1,000 Palestinians in return for female, minor, elderly, and infirm captives. Israel's also rejected other Hamas demands, leading to a standstill in indirect ceasefire talks in Qatar. Those demands include Israel fully withdrawing its forces from Gaza and allowing displaced Palestinians to return to their homes in the north of the territory. Palestinian resistance fighters have ambushed an Israeli military vehicle north of the city of Tukaram in the occupied West Bank, killing a number of soldiers. Our correspondent out of Ramallah, Mona Kandil, joined us earlier with the details.
The fighters of the Tulkarim battalion, it's one of the branches of the Saraj Jihad movement, issued a statement, and the fighters were inside in the center of the refugee camp of Nur Shams. They issued a statement saying that their fighters had set an ambush at the gate of the village of Deir Ghsoun in Tulkarim, and that north of the city of the Tulkarim, and they had monitored the movement of Israeli soldiers there, and when a vehicle where an Israeli officer and at least three soldiers arrived there, they opened fire at them directly, and the vehicle has turned, and they confirmed succeeded to kill everyone was inside the two. Withdrew after the vehicle had overturned. The Deir Ghsoun village, or the Deir Ghsoun gate, where the operation had taken place, is located in a border area northwest of Tulkarim. And it seems that the fighters succeeded to bypass the gate inside to the territories where the Israeli forces are.
Lebanon's Hezbollah resistance movement says it's carried out an operation against two Israeli military sites using over 60 rockets. Hezbollah said its new operation targeted Israel's missile and artillery base in Yoav and the Kaila barracks in occupied Golan Heights. The movement said operation came in retaliation for Israel's earlier bombing of the Lebanese city of Baalbek and in support of Palestinians in the Gaza Strip. The movement has been attacking Israeli positions since the regime began its genocide in Gaza in early October. Meanwhile, the Islamic Resistance in Iraq also announced a new anti-Israeli attack in support of Gazans. It said operation targeted the headquarters of the regime's Ministry of Military Affairs with a drone. Austrians once again rally in the capital of Vienna to call for a permanent ceasefire in Gaza, nearly 6 months into the U.S.-Israeli campaign of genocide. Protesters held signs and chanted slogans as they marched toward the city center. They called for an immediate end to Israeli massacre of Palestinians in Gaza. Demonstrators also demanded Israeli apartheid regime be dismantled. The rally was part of weekly demonstrations in solidarity with Palestinians. and this week's demonstration coincided with the 10th anniversary of the boycott, divestment, and sanctions, or BDS, movements in the country. The organizers stressed the need to boycott Israeli products and companies that collaborate with the regime during its Gaza war. Our Vienna correspondent was at the venue of the protests and spoke to some of the demonstrators.
So, to me, it's a moral obligation to boycott. It's a tool that works, that has proven that it can work, it can push countries, and that Israel needs this economic coverage, this diplomatic coverage, to continue doing what it's doing, and the human rights violation, and the genocide, and the apartheid. So I think it's a moral obligation. We should all be doing this for any cause that we consider that is violating human rights.
Yeah, well, I support BDS because I think it works. I mean, we have all these complicit companies here in Austria and worldwide, and they support the Israeli occupation, the Israeli apartheid, and the genocide which is currently happening in Gaza. And Israel is only able to continue its over 75 years of occupation and apartheid because institutions and operations worldwide support it. So we stand here, we support the BDS movement because we want to stop it.
We are joining this protest, the 10th Israeli Apartheid Week in Austria, as anti-colonial, anti-racist activists, because Palestine is in the center of the global South struggles for liberation, the struggles for the liberation against colonialism and imperialism. And it's important to support the BDS campaign and the Israel Apartheid Week because BDS has been consistently doing work in Austria for 10 years now. And it is the simplest thing that everyone who believes in humanity, who is human, should be doing. Just boycotting products that support genocide, calling for boycotts, also calling for sanctions and divestments on the state of Israel, which we are complicit in, which our government funds and supports politically.
We're here today at the protest organized by BDS Austria for the Israeli Apartheid Week 2024. We are here to support BDS Austria because Israel is a European settler state and it could not be possible, its existence could not be possible, and this genocide could not be possible without the material and moral support of the West. So it is our duty and responsibility in the West to hit the and to target the settler state of Israel where it hurts, here in the West, and its connection between our governments and the government of Israel. Austria is particularly guilty in this sense because Theodor Herzl was Austrian, so we in Austria have imminent and the most important duty to make sure that the people do not forget and the people know that there is a genocide going on, not only now, but for more than 75 years.
Now, Russia is observing a national day of mourning following a deadly terror attack in the country, the deadliest that is in the country in over two decades. Now, mourners have been laying flowers at the site in Moscow where the deadly assault happened. President Vladimir Putin has called the incident a barbaric terrorist attack. Putin said all the perpetrators, organizers, and those who ordered such a crime will be, quote, justly and inevitably punished. On Friday, gunmen stormed Moscow's Crocus City Hall, opened fire, and torched the building. At least 133 people were killed and more than 100 others wounded. The Moscow governor says the death toll is expected to rise as many of the injured are in critical condition. Russia's arrested 11 people in connection with this deadly attack.
Russian President Vladimir Putin addressed the nation after the deadly attack in Moscow, which killed dozens of civilians. The president denounced the massacre as a bloody and barbaric terrorist attack, as he declared March 24 a National Day of Mourning. At least 11 suspects, including four perpetrators who directly participated in the shooting spree, have been arrested. The four direct perpetrators were detained in Bryansk region. According to the intelligence service, the terrorists planned to cross the Russian-Ukrainian border. The Russian president vowed to punish all involved in the massacre.
All the perpetrators, organizers, and customers of this crime will suffer a fair and inevitable punishment, whoever they are, whoever guides them. I repeat, we will identify,
and punish everyone who stands behind the terrorists who prepared this atrocity, this attack on Russia, on our people.
The Daesh Takfiri terror group claimed responsibility, but Moscow has dismissed the claim, asserting that investigation is still underway to ascertain the main culprits. Russia's security service says the Moscow attackers had contacts in Ukraine supporting them. During interrogation, a detained terrorist said he was promised 5,000 rubles to carry out the terrorist attack. He claimed he watched a certain preacher on Telegram and allegedly his assistant contacted the man.
The perpetrators are ignorant, illiterate people who will commit any crime for money. The question is different. Where is the planning center? Not a single international organization can act in the international arena, especially in a state like Russia, where there are strong power structures. Performers can be found anywhere through the agents. We went through this experience in Chechnya. This once again convinces us that international terrorist structures are the work of the CIA and Western intelligence services.
The attack, which came amid Ukraine's war with Russia, was the deadliest in the country since the Beslan school siege in 2004. After Friday's attack, Putin held discussion with his Belarusian counterpart Alexander Lukashenko. Both leaders confirmed their readiness to work together in the fight against terrorism.
In his address, President Putin said Moscow attackers were preparing to flee towards Ukraine, where a window had been prepared for them with the help of Ukraine. Now it remains to be seen how Russia is going to react to the massacre, which came in a very volatile region and amid its war against Ukraine. Marina Kartunova, Moscow.
Thanks for joining in, and goodbye for now.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
It guides us through life. It has taught us everything. We should learn and appreciate what it gives us. And try to apply them to our daily lives. How is it possible? By means of Quran.
این خوندن قرآن و تلاوت قرآن قدم اول است برادران من این قدم آخر نیست
Reading and recitation of the Quran is the first step, brothers, not the last one.
هو الذي أرسل رسوله بالهدى ودين
It is he who has sent his apostle with the guidance and the religion of truth, that he may make it prevail over all religions, though the polytheists should be averse.
والذي أرسل رسوله بالهدى ودين الحق ليظهره على الدين كله ولو كره المشركون
تلاوت قرآن با صوت خوش با آداب که شیوه خاصی دارد موسیقی خاصی دارد روش خاصی دارد اینها چیزایی لازم نیست
Recitation of the Quran in nice tones should be performed according to particular methods and tones
اما این کافی نیست.
But it's not enough.
مشکل بزرگ مسلمانان دنیا دوری از قرآن. دوری از قرآن. از قرآن.
Muslims' major problem is losing touch with the Quran. 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 کتاب الله. بسم الله.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. السلام عليكم ورحمة الله.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is the part of the speech delivered on June 23, 2015 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with government officials on the occasion of the month of Ramadan. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, all praise is due to Allah, the Lord of the worlds, and peace and greetings be upon our Master and Prophet, Abul Qasim al-Mustafa, Muhammad, and upon his immaculate, pure, and chosen household, especially the one remaining with Allah on earth. O God, make our tongues firm with sawab and with wisdom. One issue that is repeated in the prayers of the auspicious month of Ramadan is drawing people's attention to the worlds after this material world, the world of death, the world of the grave, the world of the judgment day, and one's difficulties in facing divine calculations and divine questioning. This is one of the issues that exist in the prayers of the auspicious month of Ramadan. A factor that helps us control and monitor this is attention to these worlds. Paying attention to this is very important for us officials who have certain responsibilities.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
When we understand, not the weight of an atom becomes absent from him. The Holy Quran, chapter 34, verse 3. That no small move, action, and statement will escape the eyes of divine calculators after our death, and that we will be questioned about all these things. This will deeply affect our behavior, our statement, and our moves. We read in the Holy Dua of Abu Hamza, bestow mercy on me when I am on the verge of dying, and when the hands of my dear ones turn me over in my bed. This condition occurs to many people. Perhaps many people have witnessed this moment when one is on the verge of dying. You and I cannot do anything at that moment when no one is closer to us than God. And we are nearer to him than you, but you see not. The Holy Quran, chapter 56, verse 85. At that moment, no one and nothing can save us from the precipice that is ahead of us except for good deeds and divine blessings.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me. You've done for
May 28, 2016 was no ordinary day at the Cincinnati Zoo in Ohio. Something had happened in Old Zoo that became the headline of the world's news agencies in less than a few minutes.
Well, what we know is that around 4 p.m., zoo officials say they started hearing people screaming around the gorilla enclosure and then quickly sealed off the area. And this is what they saw when they came on the scene, Renee.
In fact, this incident was related to a gorilla, a 17-year-old gorilla named Harambe, who came to Cincinnati only 2 years ago. Eyewitnesses told about the unwanted entry of a 4-year-old child into Harambe's special enclosure, an enclosure that didn't seem easy to get out of. Tension rose among the visitors as Harambe approached the child. A few moments later, when he moved the boy to another part of his enclosure, tension and anxiety increased even more. 15 minutes had passed from the moment the child entered Harambe's enclosure when the zoo officials made an important decision, firing a series of shots to put an end to that chaotic day. Ancient petroglyphs prove that the relationship between humans and animals is as old as human history. A relationship that includes hunting, taming, and sometimes entertainment. It was the year 2009 when archaeologists discovered an amazing area in Egypt. The area dates back to 3500 BC, an area full of elephant's bones as well as rhinoceros, all kinds of monkeys and felidae, which was apparently built for keeping animals. This important discovery confirmed that Egyptian pharaohs were the first to build something similar to a zoo. Of course, the tradition of keeping animals existed in other parts of the world as well. Regions like Greece, Rome, Babylon, Iran, China, India, and Africa. In addition, European kings were very fond of animals.
Elephants are a notable example. In the wild, they walk up to 50 miles a day. Yet in zoos, these social and cognitively complex animals are confined in enclosed spaces where they can suffer from arthritis and joint pain. A study on African elephants showed that the average lifespan of African elephants in European zoos is less than 17 years, which is less than half the average lifespan of African elephants who are killed by poachers in the wild. And when the study looked at African elephants not affected by poaching, their average lifespan was 56 years in the wild, or more than three times as long as those kept in European zoos.
But the only problem of zoos is not keeping animals from their natural living conditions. On the other hand, intentionally or unintentionally, many animals are poisoned in zoos, sometimes by the strange foods of the visitors and sometimes by rotten or inappropriate meals. They may starve for many hours on holidays. They may not receive timely and effective veterinary treatment due to illness. Another part of the story is related to private zoos. Mysterious places full of special animals that exist in the US more than any other country. Three of the most interesting examples of these zoos are in the states of Oklahoma, South Carolina, and Florida. Three zoos with three controversial owners, Joe Exotic, Doc Antle, and Carol Baskin. Joe Exotic started his career with juggling and performing animal shows. A strange man who decided to build his own private zoo in an empty plot of land in Oklahoma in 1999. Now the vastness and facilities of his zoo are the talk of the town. A zoo that is considered a place for him to socialize with his favorite animals. The relationship between him and his tigers is a strange one, a relationship that encourages visitors to pay a significant fee to watch it. At Joe's zoo, getting close to the animals is a normal thing. Touching and caressing them is considered a part of the visit, and he himself participates in it. His armed employees are either busy taking care of the animals or protecting them 24/7. On the other hand, Joe also runs an internet program every day, a program that, along with several music albums, has managed to attract the attention of his fans.
I wake up, I go to work, but every day I get someone trying to slam me down back in the dirt. I don't care, I move on.
His products store is one of the most popular and profitable parts of this zoo. A store focused on tigers and other felidae. Doc Antle has a similar territory as Joe in South Carolina, a territory with wild animals and seemingly entertaining shows. Shows that have made him a rich and famous man in recent years. He is invited to TV shows to show everyone his wild animals. Doc Antle's fans are also fond of getting close to his animals and touching them. A dangerous, unique, and strange experience. Versus Joe Exotic and Doc Antle is Carol Baskin. A woman who calls herself an advocate of animal rights and has established a complex in the state of Florida to keep felidae. Baskin's complex is a collection of felidae who, for whatever reason, are unable to return to nature. Animals that have been abused by people like Exotic and other private owners. Baskin's controversial fight with Exotic and Antle is also about the same issue. During the past years, Baskin has been following Exotic step by step. His employees, like secret agents, monitor the movements of Exotic and his group to prevent their shows, sending emails, visiting in person, and persuading people to reject Exotic and his group are considered Baskin's works. Baskin has accused Exotic of illegal buying and selling, violence, murder, breeding and making money from animals. Accusations that have been brought to official authorities. Authorities that are going to approve a controversial law against people like Exotic and Antle.
Big Cat Public Safety Act would end the ownership of big cats as exotic pets and prohibit exhibitors from allowing the public to have contact with them.
Of course, in all these years, Exotic has resorted to countermeasures. He and his group have been engaged in physical and psychological war with Baskin for years, a fight that has reached the point of making public threats. Exotic is practicing every day with his new weapons to kill Baskin. And Baskin is trying to shut down Exotic's zoo by launching a campaign. This controversial dispute has gained other dimensions over the past 2 years. Some say that Baskin's goal is not protecting animals, but removing a competitor. It is clear that if Exotic and Anto's zoos are closed, the number of Baskin's visitors will increase. The result of this strange competition, which has spread further in the absence of law, is 2 criminal cases so far. In the first case, Exotic was sent to prison on the charge of hiring an assassin to kill Baskin. In the second case, Baskin was charged with the murder of his second husband, a man that, according to what Exotic claimed, may have been eaten by Baskin's tigers. The controversies of private zoos in the US are not limited to cases like Joe Exotic and Carol Baskin. The strangest of these cases was the incident that happened in 2011 in the state of Ohio. It was October 18th of that year when a resident of Zanesville, Ohio, saw several wild animals around his house. A few minutes later, the police were called, but the number of wild animals was much more than the police thought. One could guess where these animals came from. From the house of a strange man named Terry Thompson, a man who has been famous for his personal zoo for years. In addition to controlling the situation, the police wanted to know exactly what's happened. Police officers were able to shoot 48 wild animals by late evening, 18 Bengal tigers, 17 lions, 6 black bears, and many other animals. A terrible sight was made from the scene of killing these animals, a sight that may have seemed unavoidable to protect the people of the neighborhood and to prevent a human disaster. A few hours later, the police were able to find Thompson's dismembered body in his animal's cage, a body that, in addition to deep wounds, was hit by a bullet. Terry Thompson was a veteran of the Vietnam War, a man with strange attitudes, an outlaw, and crazy about wild animals. Over the years, he had amassed a collection of all kinds of vehicles, weapons, and of course animals, and he had his own zoo. A few months before that incident, Thompson was sent to prison on the charge of possessing illegal weapons. But after his release, everything changed. His deep disagreement with his wife made him think of revenge. A revenge centered on animals, which his wife was also very fond of. The police investigation showed that Thompson freed all the animals from their cages first and shot himself later. Although Thompson's wife returned the surviving animals after a legal battle, but that was not the end of private zoos. There are still many people like Thompson and his wife living all over the United States. Private zoos that are not known what harm will they inflict upon the animals and people of the neighborhood in the absence of law.
last fall, we brought in a new silverback to the Cincinnati Zoo. And today, Harambe is making his debut in the gorilla habitat.
Witness to this claim was a tragic incident that happened to Harambe at Cincinnati Zoo. Critics of this incident said that gorillas are smart, that they have a high ability to understand the situation and to think that Harambe could live somewhere else other than Cincinnati Zoo in a natural environment away from humans. It could not be exploited for generating income and it could still be alive. For centuries, a large part of human food and clothing has been provided by animals. But humans' behavior towards these creatures is in no way compatible with their valuable services. They are physically and mentally tortured to be an excuse for saving humans' lives and their entertainment. Incidents that constantly occur in zoos and medical laboratories. In fact, there is an obvious contradiction in the treatment of some humans towards animals. An obvious example of this contradiction lies in the pet industry. Capturing, killing, and torturing some animals while the pet market is getting bigger with weirder dimensions day by day.
There are a lot of people today who say that zoos should shut down. What do you think?
I think those arguments of zoos being part of the problem and using animals and having massive welfare issues and not educating the public and not doing conservation was true.
Years ago, the French philosopher René Descartes commented on animals. He described animals in cages as emotionless machines. He emphasized that compassion for animals is irrational. No one needs to think about their food and comfort. He used to say that we should treat them as we please. We should force animals to work. We should kill animals, hunt them, and sacrifice them for medical experiments. It should be said that, despite the fact that four centuries have passed since Descartes made these comments, our current situation is not much different from that of Descartes. A look at zoos shows that we are crueler than the time of Descartes. The cause of animal suffering and the main reason for their extinction.
Congratulations to all Iranians and everyone who celebrates the ancient festivity of Nowruz. On behalf of myself and all my colleagues here at IRIB English Radio, we wish you a wonderful Nowruz, full of happiness and prosperity.
Music.
Stories from the Past. Stories from the lives of the infallibles. Stories from different parts of the world. On the Lantern.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome. This is Lantern. And the title of today's story is The Five Loaves. Two travelers sat together on the way of their destination to have a meal. One had five loaves of bread, the other had three. A third traveler was passing by and at the request of the two joined in the meal. The travelers cut each of the loaf of bread in three equal parts. Each of the travelers ate eight broken pieces of the loaf. At the time of leaving, the third traveler took out eight dirhams and gave to the first two men who had offered him the meal and went away. On receiving the money, the two travelers started quarreling as to who should have how much of the money. The five loaf men demanded five dirhams. The three loaf men insisted on dividing the money in two equal parts. The dispute was brought to Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, the caliph of the time, to be decided. Imam Ali, peace be upon him, requested the three loaf men to accept three dirhams. The three loaf men refused and said that he would take only four dirhams. At this, Imam Ali returned. You can have only one dirham. You have eight loaves between yourselves. Each loaf was broken in three parts. Therefore, you had 24 equal parts. Your three loaves made nine parts, out of which you have eaten eight portions, leaving just one to the third traveler. Your friend had five loaves, which divided into three, made 15 pieces. He ate eight pieces and gave seven pieces to the guest. At such, the guest shared one part from your loaves and seven from those of your friend. So you should get one dirham and your friend should receive seven dirhams.
In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah, dear audience. Welcome to a new episode of Lantern from IRB English Radio. Well, in this program, we try to listen to certain religious stories and then try to talk about them and ponder about some of the important themes and lessons that we can take. And in that way, we would be able to make use of these themes and lessons in our daily lives in order to reach higher status in religion and spirituality, inshallah. Well, today we want to talk about the judgments of Imam Ali alayhi salam and the way that people were astonished by his judgment. Imam Ali alayhi salam paid very much attention to the issue of judgments. He therefore ordered Shuraih, the judge, not to execute any of his verdicts before showing them to the Imam alayhi salam, so that the Imam would be sure of the accuracy of their sentence. In the field of the etiquettes of judging between people, it is reported that a Jew once disputed with Imam Ali alayhi salam about an armor he claimed to have been his. Umar ibn Khattab, who was the judge in this case, said to the Imam alayhi salam in the court, "O Abu al-Hasan, you may stand up next to your litigant." This word upset the Imam alayhi salam very much, that the impression was clear on his face. When the trial was over, Umar asked the Imam alayhi salam about the reason for his anger. The Imam alayhi salam answered, "You have not regarded me equal to the Jew. You have called me by surname and have not done the same to him." You see, this story shows the extraordinary respect of Imam Ali alayhi salam to human beings who are involved in a judgment procedure, whether Muslims or non-Muslims. And whenever an issue was provided before Imam Ali alayhi salam, he would not pass any judgment unless he would listen to the whole claim of the two parties of litigation. Only then he would issue a verdict according to the facts wholly inferred from their statements. Well, let's go for a short break and soon we will be back.
The Lantern.
Under the light of lantern, we'll look at the story, which indicates a moral aspects of our life.
Welcome back to your audience. You're listening to Lantern, and we are talking about the judgments of Imam Ali alayhi salam and his fairness. Well, Imam Ali alayhi salam would also suspend passing a judgment before he would listen to the reply of the other party to the rival's claims. He learned such procedures from the Holy Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa sallam, who upon assigning him to convey the contents of Surat al-Bara'ah to the polytheists, said to him, "People will litigate before you. When two parties of a lawsuit present themselves before you, you must not pass any judgment for the good of the party before you listen to the defense of the other party. By doing so, you will distinguish the right from the wrong. When a piece of the testimony of a witness contradicts another piece of the same witness, Imam alayhi salam would consider the earlier piece and reject the latter. This was also one of the instructions of the Holy Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam to him, when he said, "When one testifies to a matter and then contradicts his testimony, we will consider his first testimony and reject the other." When he would discover the falsity of the testimony of a witness, Imam Ali alayhi salam would punish him severely. He would send him to the mocker place to expose him so much that all people would recognize him as a false witness and would then detain him for several days. And that is a beautiful explanation of how Imam Ali alayhi salam would treat the wrongdoers and how fair he treated them. Well, dear listeners, it seems that our time for this episode of Lantern has come to its end. I really hope that you have enjoyed this episode. Protect you all. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
We are fortunate enough to follow infallible and knowledgeable imams, starting by Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib and ending with Imam Muhammad al-Mahdi, ajallallah ta'ala farajahu sharif. So one good point that Shia enjoys is that we are inherited with a bunch of narrations and traditions from Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib up until Imam Mahdi. In according to the, you know, time and place situation, they have provided different gifts. So Amirul Mu'minin Ali ibn Abi Talib, when died, after his demise, Shi'i scholars tried to combine and collect sayings of Ahlul Bayt. One of the Shi'i scholars, who called Sayyid Ravi, collected a part of Alavi sayings. He says that I tried my best, but unfortunately I couldn't collect all sayings of Ali ibn Abi Talib. It seems that he has collected 1/10 of all Alavi sayings in form of Nahjul Balagha. They are so precious in terms of oral and command of language that Sayyid Radi called Nahjul Balagha, the way of talk, the way of approach. So Nahjul Balagha is a volume which includes 1/10 of Alavi sayings. And these 1/10, even you come up with ocean of knowledge with regard to belief system, with regard to morality and moral values, with regard to rulings, with regard to the history and lessons that we could take from history, and also with regard to life skill.
That was all for today. Thank you very much for joining us.
Inshallah, we continue this topic on the next episode. Till then, may Allah bless all of you. Fi amanillah.
ألا بذكر الله تطمئن القلوب.
The situation in northern Gaza is beyond desperate, says the UN Agency for Palestine Refugees, UNRWA. Greetings, everyone, and thanks for joining us again. As always, let's kick things off with a quick review of some of the latest developments. The U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken was in Tel Aviv as part of continuing negotiations towards an exchange deal and a ceasefire in the coastal enclave. Meantime, a Washington-drafted resolution vetoed by Russia and China, who said it didn't go far enough and it should have demanded a ceasefire. In the UK, an argument between the British Foreign Minister David Cameron and apartheid Israel spin doctor Ayalon Levy, the spokesman, over Tel Aviv's blocking of international aid into the strip that has caused famine conditions. Yemen's Ansarullah resistance movement vows more effective retaliatory strikes in support of the Palestinian people in the Gaza-Bantustan. In the West Bank, one Palestinian man is murdered and seven Israeli occupation forces injured in clashes near the Dolev illegal settlement northwest of Ramallah. In Gaza, tens of Palestinians have been killed in Israeli raids across the world's largest open-air prison in the past 24 hours alone. And since October last year, Israeli occupation forces have killed at least 32,000 Palestinian men, women, and children, and wounded more than 74,000 others. With us for this edition of the program, in the studio, British-Palestinian journalist and filmmaker Yusuf Al-Halou, and alongside him, Paris-based blogger and activist Wafa Jawad. A warm welcome to you both. I'll start with you, Wafa. More than 32,000 killed, over 74,000 wounded, as I just mentioned. Your thoughts on the scale of Israel's genocidal war on Gaza so far?
It's absolutely horrendous that this is still going on, and yet there's almost a blind eye to it all. And those who have the power are yet still silent. However, the people are not silent. The people have been galvanizing. They have been protesting. It is unbelievable that a genocide is being witnessed by millions, globally witnessed live on their phones. And you know, as a journalist, you know, I'm more than horrified that over 77%, 77 journalists have reportedly been killed and shot. I would call that murdered, for just doing their job, for, you know, trying to tell the actual story that what's happening in Gaza.
Absolutely, and without those journalists getting the word out, the truth out,